Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
So I did that myself. This was my little thought. And I phoned TD Bank, I phoned Citibank, I phoned Wells Fargo. And I actually got real people. And it was so interesting at Wells Fargo when I said to the person, you know, I don't have an account with your bank. What I'm calling for is I have a message that I want you to send on up the line to the CEO of your bank. So she was interested. Well, what is that? And I said, I want Wells Fargo to not fund the Dakota Access Pipeline. And she just gasped and she said, no, you're kidding. We're not funding that, are we? And I said, well, you know, you might want to share with your colleagues what the bank is doing. And she said, don't you worry, hon. I got a big, fat mouth.
That's our guest, Fran Korten, publisher of Yes Magazine, talking about how her decision to take matters into her own hands started a national movement to pressure big banks directly over their investment in the Dakota Access Pipeline. Hello again. I'm Walt McCree, co-host of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown and chair of the Public Banking Institute. Our program this week will consider what action is underway in some parts of our country that represents people moving toward taking more control over how their money is used in the world and how it's managed. So we'll talk with Fran Korten about a redux of the Move Your Money campaign from years ago after Occupy Wall Street. And then we'll take a bit of a closer look at how some new efforts to create public banks are raising core organizational issues, as well as creating new pathways for getting cities and other governments to move the process along. We'll also hear from our colleague in Santa Fe, which this past week cleared more ground as it carefully moves toward creation of its own public bank, which may be the first in the country since 1919. But the stage of global finance has also been in the news lately, featuring one of the banks that's also involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline.
So, Ellen, the last couple of weeks, we've been watching the global banking cartel continue to entertain us on the big stage of scandal. And Wells Fargo's little business with the unrequested accounts has gotten it into a heap of trouble.
I've heard that I think 1/7 of their depositors have pulled out. Those are individual depositors, but what's more interesting to me is the fact that cities and counties and states are either discontinuing business relations with Wells Fargo or talking about it. California, for example, has discontinued relations. Wells Fargo had generated over 2 million fraudulent accounts, so it was an industry-wide practice. I mean, it wasn't just one or two guys doing fraudulent things. And before that, when Goldman Sachs got caught in some major frauds, I remember Chicago discontinued relations and some other cities. Mm-hmm. So we have a Move Your Money movement, not just among individuals, which was what the original Move Your Money movement was all about, but by local, state and local governments. So then the question is, what do they do with their money? First of all, this is a lot more money. I mean, that can have a significant impact on the banks. Hmm. But then where do they put their money? The local community banks don't really want it anymore because of the collateralization requirements. In California, I think they have to have 110% collateral, which means basically they have to put up more in the way of securities than they get in the way of deposits.
So that means that when the bank gets deposits, that gives them some liquidity to make loans, which is where they make money. And what you're describing is that municipal and government deposits that have to be collateralized means that even though they've got lots of this money from the government sources, they can't use it.
Right. They basically used it to buy collateral, which would be probably federal short-term securities, which pay almost nothing. So it's not much good to them. And the community banks don't really have the facilities to handle the business of a big, well, California vacillates between being the sixth largest economy in the world and the eighth largest economy in the world. I mean, it's huge. It's the size of a country. So its banking needs are also huge, and it needs, you know, international or, you know, major banking. And it's something that community banks can't handle. So then the question is, where do they put their money? And our response to that, of course, is that they should open their own depository banks, just like the Bank of North Dakota does. So they would be their own banker's bank or money center bank, basically not necessarily dealing directly with customers, but dealing with large amounts of money and the flow of money and the liquidity of money the way the Bank of North Dakota does. In other words, they partner with the local banks to help them with capitalization and liquidity rather than actually being out in the field doing basic retail banking themselves. So I just wrote an article on that. Well, this is all California-based, but California has a proposition now that's on the ballot for next week, Proposition 51, which is for a $9 billion bond issue sponsored by big developers to do school infrastructure. And, of course, we need the school infrastructure. And the bond actually on its face kind of looks good compared to the capital appreciation bonds that that we've had before, where these local governments, like in Orange County, they're paying up to 1,500% over 34 or 40 years. It's like a no payment until the end, and then you get this gigantic payment because of compound interest.
Well, that could actually threaten their financial viability completely, couldn't it?
I mean, oh, you would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're passing a gigantic debt onto their children or grandchildren. And in 40 years, the thing they built may have deteriorated. I mean, they're not going to get anything for this huge amount of money that they're going to owe. So those have actually been called illegal. And I mean, now there's a little cap, so it can only be four times principal. But four times principal is huge. But this bond issue is $9 billion times 35 years times 5%. So the amount of interest that they would pay over the course of the thing is about $16 billion.
All right, so $16 billion in interest
on
a loan
of
$9 billion.
Yeah, so it's close to double for interest
such
on top
a deal.
Of the nine. But if they did it through their own bank, but the interest or the cost of funds through your own state-owned bank, by my calculations, is about $4.5 billion. So they would save $11 billion on the interest. And then if you pay back their $1 billion capitalization at the end of the thing, then you'd be saving $10 billion on a $9 billion bond.
Well, that's the right kind of math cities need to have in their wheelhouse. The cities around the country that are struggling with credit are just growing. You know, it seems like it's unending, the cycle of trouble that is facing municipalities, cities, and states. And they continue to buy into these fancy financial deals that Wall Street sells them and get more and more into trouble. So the public bank thing, again, becomes a more interesting and more necessary, actually more urgent. Where you were talking about moving money, one of the things that has happened also this past week or so out in North Dakota, our famed North Dakota, has trouble with the locals, and the locals being the native tribes, the Sioux, and the thousands of people who are supporting them as these big banks, 17 big banks, fund the Dakota Access Pipeline. Funding directly by 17 banks. And what has happened out of an article that was done in Yes Magazine, which is published by Fran Corton, who we'll talk to later, started a nationwide call-in that flooded and shut down the phone numbers and emails of these banks because they published contact numbers for ING Bank, Intesa San Paolo, Credit Agricole, TD Security, Citibank, Bank of Tokyo, SunTrust, etc., Wells Fargo, of course, not to leave out Wells Fargo, and so forth. So all of these banks were posted on the screen, and people have been calling in and saying, I'm moving my money out of your bank. And it's been quite successful, and I think quite interesting to see how people get engaged with what their money is actually doing in the world.
We're seeing a number of wave of new interest in public banks. You know, we actually founded the Public Banking Institute in early 2011, and immediately within a year, 20 states had bills pending of one sort or another for state-owned banks or feasibility studies or something, but they didn't pass, and so, you know, it kind of went underground for a while. But I think during all that time, it was taking root. The idea had to take hold, but it seems to me that it is taking hold. So we're hearing about new waves of interest in public banking all over the place, and we're going to talk to Nicole Lichen pretty soon on what's happening in Santa Fe, and then we've reported before on the exciting developments in New Jersey, et cetera.
And Philadelphia and numerous others. It definitely is a hot topic. I'm under the impression that financial executives in these places are all in need of some new educational tools.
Yeah, they're actually shooting themselves in the foot because they're giving away their power to create the credit that they need to develop their economies. They're giving it away to Wall Street to develop their portfolios.
Yeah, it's very interesting because the public bank prospect literally changes the game entirely. It suddenly provides the opportunity to create credit on your own instead of having to go back to borrow it from somebody who's going to charge you a lot of money for it. And that's the cycle that needs to be broken, of course, and I don't know of any other way that's going to be broken unless, you know, we reclaim that right to generate our own money, our own credit anyway.
I spoke last Sunday to a group in Englewood, Colorado. It was a great group. I mean, they're very committed, very activist, and very interested, and they were obviously far along in the public banking process and thinking, and they are saying that, you know, why aren't we doing it? Once people get it, they all hit their foreheads and say, no-brainer, why aren't we doing this? The reason is people don't get it yet, and so you need the 5% that brings on change, a certain level of awareness, and then things.
Yeah. Not only do they not hear it because it's not talked about, you know, public banks being a new topic, relatively new topic, and the big banks, of course, the global banks having no interest in the success of public banks, that's one part of not getting it. The other part of it is that people don't get that that what banks do is create new money. And so it's a doubly difficult sort of an access point. But boy, once they get it, it's pretty exciting to see how people get turned on to the prospect that the things that they want to see happen in their community, in their cities, in their states, suddenly become a possibility because they realize that they're good for it. They can lend themselves the money, make great savings, and make decent profits. I mean, New Mexico, Santa Fe's evaluation showed exactly how profitable it can be, even with a very small capital investment. I think maybe Nicole can tell us more about that.
Right.
Well, Ellen, it's always good to talk to you.
Likewise. Great talking.
Lots going on, right? Pretty exciting world in public banking.
It is. Yes.
After a bit, we'll be talking with Nicole Lichen, one of the Santa Fe public banking pioneers, about the new progress for creating a public bank there. Every once in a while, opportunities come along for true colors to emerge. And things get really colorful when these opportunities are in the public eye. One such example is the recent peaceful but determined confrontation between the Standing Rock Sioux of North Dakota and the owners of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is planned to go under a river and sacred burial ground belonging to the Sioux. The issues here are many, as we'll hear in a moment, but the thing that interests us is how individuals who see their money being invested in projects by these banks violates their personal sense of commitment to issues that are much bigger than just their bank accounts, and how they're pushing back against their banks and demanding that they withdraw from the project. Now, while this protest may not result in the bank's actual withdrawal from the project, it's already accomplished some surprising results, not the least of which is enlivening the public's understanding that their money has power beyond what it can buy at a store. We spoke with Fran Korten, the publisher of Yes Magazine, who took this bank versus earth versus tribe confrontation a step further. She told us about what's behind this new level of activism by citizens at this site.
Standing Rock has kind of become ground zero in a much, much larger set of concerns. On the one hand, it's about climate change and the tremendous movement to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, never burn them, because if we burn, the amount of reserves that are already identified by the big fossil fuel companies, we're going to burn up this planet. So there are protests all over the world and in the United States against the infrastructure that is being pushed to make sure that all those fossil fuels are, in fact, burned. So whether it's pipelines, the Keystone Pipeline became famous, or it's coal terminals, or it's railroad lines, or gas lines, all of these things have become targets for activists. And the Standing Rock interest in what's going on there derives partly from that large movement. On the other hand, it's also a movement about native rights. So the Standing Rock Sioux have certain rights over the lands that will be traversed by the Dakota Access Pipeline. And they're saying, wait a minute, we didn't get consulted on this. And this pipeline, it's not just about the fossil fuels that it's going to enable to be burned. It's also about our water. So the people at Standing Rock are calling themselves not protesters, but water protectors. So people have flocked to Standing Rock. Many, many native tribes. It's united the tribes in this struggle, partly over the rules of native sovereignty and partly over the desecration of sacred lands, the pollution of water, and the larger climate change questions. So it's become a flashpoint, and of course now the state of North Dakota is really calling out the troops, quite literally. So they have their police, their National Guard, they're calling on police from seven other states to help them out. And a very, very militarized operation is taking place. And this is, of course, riling up people who care about native rights and people who care about climate change and people who care about water. That's the big context that has created such interest in what is happening at Standing Rock. And at Yes Magazine, we've been following this really closely. We've published more than 36 stories, many of them by Native American writers, just helping people understand what is unfolding, what's the meaning of it, how do we come to understand this.
And so one of the outcomes of your publishing has been a new spontaneous citizen movement. Describe that to us.
Well, what's really interesting here, Walt, is the connection to the banks that are funding the Dakota Access Pipeline. Bill McKibben wrote an article for Yes Magazine essentially saying, look, not everybody can go to Standing Rock, but what we can do is open up a different activist front, and that is to protest the banks that are funding this multi-billion dollar project. So to put together a project this large takes a lot of banks. And he noted that there are some of those banks are household names like Citibank and Wells Fargo, TD Bank, etc. So he suggested that people might organize some kind of a little protest outside the local branch of Wells Fargo or Citibank. So I read that story myself, and I thought, that's kind of a lot of work to organize a protest in front of the bank. Why don't I just phone the bank? So I did that myself. This was my little thought, and I phoned TD Bank, I phoned Citibank, I phoned Wells Fargo.
Uh-huh.
And I actually got real people. I had to push the zero button a whole lot of times because I don't have an account and I don't have a credit card and I do not bank with any of those banks. But eventually I got real people, and it was so interesting. Walt, at Wells Fargo, when I said to the person, I said, you know, I don't have an account with your bank. What I'm calling for is I have a message that I want you to send on up the line to the CEO of your bank. So she was interested. Well, what is that? And I said, I want Wells Fargo to not fund the Dakota Access Pipeline. And she just gasped, and she said, no, you're kidding. We're not funding that, are we? And I said, well, I'm delighted that you know all about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And she said, well, of course, I read the news. And I said, well, you know, you might want to share with your colleagues what the bank is doing. And she said, don't you worry, hon, I got a big, fat mouth. So,
okay, so they pulled out the Dakota Access Pipeline following that
yes.
call.
So I thought this is a cool strategy.
Right.
So I wrote it up on Facebook on the Bill McKibben post.
Right.
And I said, look, this is what I'm doing. And our editor, our editorial director, Tracy Dunn, saw my post on Facebook, and she commissioned an article that would list the names, phone numbers, emails of the CEOs of all the 17 banks that are funding the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Wow.
So we published that, and it has totally taken off.
Wow.
And I think what we're seeing is that people are telling, well, I emailed this, but that email seemed to be dead. They seem to have turned it off or something. Or they say,
right.
you know, I got this person on the phone, and it, you know, this is what I said. People are sharing like crazy about their communications with these banks. And it was interesting that a couple of days ago, we got an email from one of the banks. It was the Scotiabank, and they said, look, we are not funding the Dakota Access Pipeline. Please take our email off of your site because we are getting flooded with emails.
Wow. Wow.
So that was very confirming.
Yeah.
People are so ready to act. And, of course, this will be of particular interest to you all at the Public Banking Institute. Many people were saying, I am closing my account with Citibank or Wells Fargo or whichever one it was, and I'm moving my money to a credit union.
Mm-hmm.
So you could begin to see kind of this blending of the whole move your money movement that arose particularly after Occupy Wall Street, as you well know, with this new movement that combines native rights, climate change, and now the issues of the global banking system.
Yeah.
So that's a potent combination. And I will tell you, our website's just burning up. We haven't seen this much traffic for some time.
That's very encouraging. And I realize that as people get connected with their money and what the money does in the world, by taking an action like that, they've really bridged the gap or even the chasm between their consciousness of what their money's doing and their own responsibility.
Yes, you know, I think that. I think people are eager to act on that. That,
yes.
You know, moving your money out of one bank and into another is kind of complicated to tell the truth. But as people really grasp these interconnections of multiple things that they care about, it really begins to stoke the motivation to actually take that action.
And the insistence that people can ultimately make by reclaiming control of their money on different priorities is really going to be up to us to act on some level, on many levels, because it's not going to happen if the people don't insist on it. You know, I mean, it's not going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from state capital. It's not going to come from the banks. As you said before, you know, their money is completely invested in burning this stuff up and in maximizing profits in the most immediate way, regardless mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. things that we value. So maybe this is what it looks like to transform.
Yes, exactly. I think it's this confluence of issues that people are coming to understand in new ways and realizing the kind of the depth of the transformation in our society that is required if we are really going to get onto a path of sustainability and justice and a way of living that is in consonance with the rhythms of the earth and our natural desire to actually cooperate with one another and have a peaceful world.
Yeah, it's truly that day, because what we see, of course, is at the moment there are no options to commercial or private banking, aside from credit unions, and of course the community banks are typically private. But I'm talking about the big banks that really run the world.
Sure.
And we see that that is a dimension beyond our control, and there are no options until public banking comes into the picture, where the opportunity to reclaim control of at least some of our money enables people to act and create public policy that reflects the values and the commitments that we make to each other, what we consider to be a standard part of the social contract. You know,
right.
We look after each other, and our resources need to be directed that way. Well, the public banking option is showing up around the country in a variety of very exciting ways now. And, of course, in addition to the Dakota Access Pipeline protest of moving money and so forth, is the reaction around the country against Wells Fargo. People are, cities and states and counties are pulling their business out of Wells Fargo. It's costing them a ton of certainly a bad will. Their stock is now almost junk from what I understand. But of course, that imperils us all, because if Wells would go down, probably the others would fall too. But maybe our business isn't so big as to make Wells imperiled. But it is yet another sign of how people will reorganize ourselves in some sort of a forceful and creative way. Are there any follow-up steps about this protest for you?
Our plan is to stick with this. So some media, you know, kind of swoop in when it gets exciting and then swoop out.
Yep.
While we're kind of there to stay. Banks don't like to get a lot of negative publicity. And when lots of people are phoning and emailing, they are clearly noticing, as was the case with the Scotiabank that asked us to please take down their name. So I think as the movement kind of continues at Standing Rock, in terms of the banking side, the need is really just to keep that pressure on.
We've been talking with Fran Corton, the publisher of Yes Magazine, about their recent editorial foray into the confrontation over the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Now we're going to visit with a free thinker, somebody who's actually created some new ideas and new systems that have been around for years and have demonstrated the power of community and the benefit of local currencies. His name is Paul Glover. Paul is a nationally known community organizer who devised the famous Ithaca dollars, the complementary currency in Ithaca, New York, where the notion of money suddenly took on a new kind of meaning. He's been involved in, or created from his own free thinking, numerous civic projects that deal with the well-being of people and the planet, such as the Ithaca Health Alliance, Philadelphia Orchard Project, Citizen Planners of Los Angeles, and he's authored several books and is a former professor of urban studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. He recently wrote a brief statement for a Bretton Woods Economic Roundtable that caught my eye. In it, he stated some simple truths followed by some simple advice. And so I thought we'd talk to him about it. In that piece, he wrote, "Control of money decides who has power and who obeys, who lives well and who struggles, what is built and for whom, what is protected and what is destroyed. Whether issued by governments or by bankers, all modern money is in debt to nature, because our economies extract from nature faster than we replenish. Today," Paul continues, "to balance the global economy, to prevent famines and revolutions that might risk every home, I believe that green local economies must rapidly build green infrastructure, to provide money dedicated to this task, and to fully employ every person, I believe that labor should become the new gold standard. 25 years ago in Ithaca, New York, Paul began issuing our denominated commodity currency, backed by a specific list of goods and services, and millions of dollars were created and traded in Ithaca. And he continued elsewhere in that statement to say that regional credits especially serve people when their issuance is democratically managed, when they expand local craft and agriculture, when they provide interest-free loans and grants for local projects. All of these items are things that potentially public banks could help foster around America. So let's talk with Paul about his economic and monetary view of the direction we should be heading.
In the midst of the crisis of the middle class, there's an opportunity to begin some very basic changes. And unless we do, the decline of the middle class can become a very dangerous thing. And we're hearing that kind of voice at this time. So making fundamental changes in our systems of food, fuel, housing, health care, education, transportation, and finance are essential and are all about us to be done.
And so many interesting options, Paul. Your comment to the Bretton Woods gathering here, I thought, really touched on some primary points, but also some very insightful ones. And just speaking to what you just said there, I really love that you pointed out how control of money decides how, you know, who has the power and who obeys. We all, of course, know that intuitively, but we don't really realize that there's an option to having that power controlled by others, that we have a chance that we can actually control the commerce and the monetary system that surrounds us. Your creation of Ithaca dollars and the complementary currencies that have sprung up, I think, since then, illustrate that. And you talk about complementary currencies being loyal to the people and to the planet. Would you say some more about that?
Yeah, I have felt that on the one hand, a national currency, whether issued by banks or the government directly, is a top-down system, and that such money controls people. By contrast, the local currency connects people, and it connects us based on our skills and our capabilities, and brings to the marketplace those things which the conventional or larger markets do not necessarily respect, or do not as reliably respect. So it is the grassroots ferment, the capabilities of average people are brought to the fore in such local economies, regional economies, and facilitated by local currencies and regional currencies. And 25 years ago, I started a local currency called Ithaca Hours, and our was the denomination with a $10 equivalent, at the time doubling the minimum wage. And it enabled us to certainly have more money in the community, supplemental to the dollars we had. We gained control of interest rates. We decreased our dependence on external sources and the empire. We strengthened local small businesses.
Yeah.
We closed the radius. We made it more able to meet our needs within a smaller radius rather than importing from great distances.
Yeah.
Investing, we made loans without charging interest.
And you created millions of dollars worth of value in the local economy of Ithaca. And that money came from, or was created from, the labor, from the hours of the people who lived there. So you mentioned...
Exactly. Our money was not backed by gold or silver. Neither, of course, are dollars since 1969, 1971. Our money was backed by a list of thousands of ways one could spend local currency for goods, services, and ultimately thousands of individuals and 500 businesses participated, including the hospital, the bank, movie theaters, bowling alleys, health club, restaurants, public library for overdue fines, and the transit system. You could buy anything at all in Ithaca, New York with our money, H-O-U-R money. Hours are a measure, I would emphasize, as steady as the clock, whereas dollars are our fiat money, which rises or falls according to the full faith and credit of a government which is trillions of dollars in debt. And that, in fact, all national currencies are in debt to nature because our modern economies extract from nature faster than we replenish.
Yeah,
a local currency is capable of targeting investment and emphasizing or strengthening transactions within a green economy, which revives nature.
That's a really essential distinction between the economic model that all of us have to live in or that we live in, and then the one that we can move forward where there is an economy built around what nature actually how nature will sustain us once we align with that. And your point about ours being steady is really quite an interesting analogy. So labor becomes the new gold standard, you say, and that this time, that these hours don't replace dollars that are in the economy, but they replace the lack of money.
Yes, exactly.
So people there's a much more even playing field, a chance for people to, for everyone to participate in this sort of an enterprise. I liked a comment that you made in your statement where it said that at the same time regional monies stimulate neither bloodthirsty capitalism nor bleeding heart socialism. They foster instead mutual enterprise, and that this mutual enterprise, this partnership of businesses, creates something that replaces the threatened middle class with something that you call the mutual class.
Exactly. I have been promoting this notion. In fact, I'm writing a book titled From the Middle Class to the Mutual Class. And the mutual class thrives by getting together. The middle class has been vulnerable for four basic reasons. First, it's a sink or swim system, whereas every house in any neighborhood sinks or swims based on its own ability to pay the rent, pay the mortgage, pay its basic bills. Secondly, it is it's a consumer class.
Mm-hmm.
We are a consumer class. We are stimulated to buy things, and that's the way we display our success within the middle class. And thirdly, we have to have a lower class beneath us, the contrast by which you contrast ourselves. And fourthly, we have become gradually more and more dependent upon the very institutions which currently are dissolving us. The mutual class, by contrast, gets ahead by getting together, and so we create, in the nonprofit sector, we create cooperatives for food and housing and health care. And in the for-profit sector, especially with what are called B corporations, we foster enterprise which is dedicated to community and to nature.
And it would seem, or maybe it's just obvious now, that the consumptive and exploitive industries of the old world are going to collapse because they are not sustainable, and so that we have to move into these new ways of thinking about our interrelationship with money as well as economy. That's our evolutionary path at the moment, would you say?
It's huge. It's gigantic because we've been saturated for a century with advertisements encouraging us to define our success and our value as persons according to how much stuff we can buy and own and play with and throw away, and in a very competitive sense to rise by contrast with the people around us, and to emphasize a more communitarian, not communistic, but communitarian, a democracy which is celebrating our creativity rather than our consumerism, is a huge cultural shift. And this is a challenge, of course, to the entire infrastructure of an economy which hires people to manage a system of consumption. And it's a challenge, in fact, which invites us to rebuild civilization altogether and entirely. I emphasize and work within cities, particularly where most people are and more people are going to live, that they become beautiful places to live and as beautiful as the children within them, so that we are less inclined to spread out all over the countryside and convert farmland into suburb. That, again, yet another component of vast cultural change, that we return to towards cities where we can live more energy efficiently, and money and investment needs to move in that direction, I believe.
How do you see the role of public banking, publicly owned public interest banks, serving this sort of mission or vision?
Oh, clearly a powerful and essential component. We transfer the priority for investment from a global system, which is indifferent to what happens to communities or nature, toward local and regional and urban, particularly, systems of money, which have as a priority investment in these very processes that we've begun to speak about. And the public bank does this directly. It says we have a local capability, local capital, and local priorities. And whether that is local, regional, or statewide, certainly has a greater loyalty, or needs to be reminded that it has a greatest loyalty toward these priorities and these values.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I thank you very much for taking the time this morning.
If people would like to follow up and have further conversation with me, I'm available through paulglover.org, and I'd be very happy to collaborate with whoever is interested.
That's noted innovator and author Paul Glover, G-L-O-V-E-R, the author of a new book called From Middle Class to Mutual Class. Now we head to the Southwest to get an update on progress in Santa Fe, in that community's pursuit of creating its own public bank. Santa Fe has been out front of other cities around the U.S. in this initiative, and there's been a strong local team on the ground there to help the city along in making the necessary steps. It's a good look at what this process involves for those of you who'd like to create a public bank in your city or state. We spoke with one of the originators of the citizen movement, Nicole Lycan, who was one of the founders of Banking on New Mexico and is a board member at the Public Banking Institute.
So tell us about what's going on. Where do things stand? Santa Fe being really the pioneer for the next public bank in America after 97 years. There are some people who are hot on your tail, but you guys are in the lead. What's the status of the public bank initiative there?
Well, you know, we completed an economic feasibility study early January of this year, was completed for the city of Santa Fe, as well as the team that I'm part of, the Brass Tacks team. We completed our own feasibility study called a five-year model. And then things just kind of slowed down for a pretty long time, except that we kept busy. We wrote the next phase of legislation for city councilors, and that's legislation to take the next steps for the city. And we learned that our resolution had been introduced at city council last week. And now what's happening is it will be going to different committees. It's going to the finance committee, and then it's going to a business and economic development, and as well the city council will be voting on it on the 14th of December. So it's just absolutely perfect timing. We're very excited.
Is that the end of the road then in terms of the approval for the bank? Will in the 16th
of December?
Well, I mean in terms of the approval, is it on an irreversible track?
Well, we like to think so. You never know with politics. But the task force resolution, which we wrote, appoints a task force of 9 people, bankers, lawyers, representatives from the community, people that know banking, and they are appointed to find the path forward for applying for a bank charter. And it's to gather all that, you know, pretty intense information that is needed in order to apply for a bank charter. So once that's done, it's maybe 6 months to a year after you apply for the charter that mm-hmm. you would actually get your bank charters. Uh-huh. Keep in mind, we started this process right after you and Ellen were in Santa Fe, September of 2014, but we've just kept it moving right along.
Yeah, so it's been 2 years, and you're getting very, very close. What does the numbers look like in the modeling that you've done? I believe you said that you thought that the initial capitalization of the bank was only going to be $9 million, But you also said it was going to produce a remarkable set of returns.
Right. Our model shows that by just investing $10 million in a bank that we can turn a profit in the first year of operation, and after 5 years, we will have earned $10.5 million in profit. And this is for just a really little bitty bank, really, compared to most banks. The bank that we're looking at basically will be refinancing some of the city's existing debt, and also will help do lending to the city for infrastructure and facilities, things that the public all need. So instead of borrowing the money from someone else, some other state or some other place and paying them back in interest, they'll be borrowing from our own bank and paying the city back with interest. That's what our five-year model predicts, and it's a conservative model. And as the bank grows, of course, the profits will increase, and more of those profits can be returned back to the community. We're very excited. Of course, we do need to put some of the profits back into the bank so it can grow its capacity to lend. So some of them will stay there and get invested in increasing the capital in the bank, and then some can get returned to the city right from the beginning.
Have you gotten into the point where the city is drafting the mission of the bank?
No, that's what's going to happen through public process with the task force. So that's one of the tasks of the task force, is to help, is to work with the public to identify the mission for the bank. The mission, governance, capitalization, all the nitty-gritty, everything you need to do in order to apply for a bank charter.
I saw that there was a concern about governance. Everybody always worries about cronyism and the politicians getting their hand in it, but it sounds like you've got that covered by...
We're doing our level best to have public participation and transparency really be part of it, and we've got good people that are very eager to help that happen. We've got a public participation process where they have to meet with the public to get their input at least twice during the 6 months the task force is working.
Do you have a sense of what your mission is going to be?
Well, like I said, we're looking at first funding the stuff that the city already knows how to do, and that's infrastructure. And with our model, we look at partnership lending like the Bank of North Dakota does. Just a small part, just starting out even in the first year, is kind of a promise where they partner for small business loans or maybe for financing student loans. You know, we have really a problem in Santa Fe with attracting teachers, nurses, and if we offered student loans for the people that we need to be working in Santa Fe, it could benefit the city on a number of levels, as well as providing, you know, a small number of low-interest student loans for those nurses and doctors and those people.
Yeah, big changes at the hands of the people, which is what I think is really valuable to note, because so much of the change that we live with is dropped down on us by people who have the power to, you know, create policies and outcomes that we don't have a chance to do. And this is just the opposite, you know, the chance for the people to reclaim control and state a commitment to getting some new results. I think it's very exciting, and thank you very much for sharing the update, Nicole.
That's Nicole Lichen of Santa Fe's Brass Tax Team talking about the initiatives to start a public bank in Santa Fe. On today's Public Banking Report, we're going to discuss one of the most problematic questions that immediately arises when you tell someone that you want to give your local or state government its own bank. Folks will look at you as if you're crazy and ask you, what, you're going to give those crooks a bank? Well, we all know the public servants are not crooks, but the concern of overt influence and special dealing is a legitimate one, and one that needs to be addressed from the very start of discussions about creating publicly owned banks. The Public Banking Institute's senior advisor, Mike Krause, tells us how we can overcome that concern right from the start.
Thanks, Walt. Across the nation, efforts are moving forward to create public banks at the state level and the municipal level both. There have been a series of studies, resolutions, and task forces. Common to all these efforts now, as we get down to the actual how-to of creating a bank, are these issues: mission, operations, capital, deposit base, governance, and management. Of these, perhaps governance is the most important challenge for those advocates of public banks. The knock on public banks will be, of course, that you wouldn't want to let politicians have their hands on a bank. We can all understand how that might be. And in fact, the so-called public bank in Los Angeles, an infrastructure bank, collapsed because it was poorly managed because politicians had too much to say. So here's the challenge. On the one hand, it is the people's money, and their elected authority is going to have some say. On the other hand, you don't want politicians running the bank. That's pretty clear. How do we meet these studies? Santa Fe, New Mexico has passed the study phase and now looking at a task force to go forward with creating the bank. They've addressed this question by limiting the role of political authority in that task force. Of the 9 members of the proposed task force, only one is a city council member. One represents the city finance department. 3 have knowledge of local banking. One must have experience of the banking industry in New Mexico. One must have regulatory experience. And 2 are residents at large of the city who expressed a commitment to the goal of establishing a public bank. So you can see in Santa Fe, structuring the task force was key to limiting political meddling in that task force. In Philadelphia, proponents have taken another task. They proposed a preliminary model for a public bank, which addresses specifically governance and management as 2 separate issues. The Philadelphia proposal is that the bank be governed by a commission comprised of the mayor, the treasurer, and the president of city council. These are all independently elected members of the community with separate political authority. They serve different terms. This moves the bank out of the cycle of elections. These commissioners serve without compensation. They have no staff or employees, but they are responsible to ensure the officers of the bank, the management, achieve mission and, of course, behave lawfully and undertake those programs consistent with the law and mission. A unique feature of this Philadelphia proposal is that the commission shall be advised by a 15-member Citizens Advisory Committee, which again takes more input from the community. This is again tied back to political authority, but without giving any kind of political control. Members of this advisory committee are nominated by the mayor and confirmed by city council, and they serve staggered terms, just as do the commissioners. Again, they serve without compensation. The object here is not to create a patronage machine, but an advisory council. One of the important powers of the commissioners is that they get to remove the chief executive officer of the bank for cause. This gives them some say. If the mission is not achieved, if there's obvious fraud, if there's mismanagement, they can step in. They also have the power to approve the manning table and set salary levels upon recommendation of the management. The management is another item altogether. That is a 7-member board of directors, again, appointed by the mayor, confirmed by city council, serving staggered terms, all to have experience in banking in and around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. They can be removed by 2/3 vote of council. So if you see a director not doing his job, he can be removed by the political authority, but not easily. This management team appoints the chief executive officer, who in turn staffs the bank and runs the bank. So you can see levels of separation, yet with accountability to the political authority. So going forward, at the state level, or at the city level, or at a county level, or even a regional level, there are important issues to address, but none more important than governance. We have models now in Santa Fe, in Philadelphia, in Tacoma, and elsewhere, to achieve a well-run bank that has defined mission, but that is managed independently of political authority by competent professional bankers, but yet who are ultimately responsible to the political authority. And that's how we go forward. This is Mike Krause for Public Banking.
A number of events have taken place since the production of this program began, not the least of which is the election of a new president of the United States, a rather seismic political and cultural event that has just about everyone from both sides of the aisle sitting up and taking notice of the change underway in front of us. Some commentators have attributed Donald Trump's success at the polls as an expression of outrage by large swaths of the American public who have been economically disenfranchised after decades of deteriorating financial conditions and sacrifice that has hollowed out the notion of the American dream. People have had enough, is one thumbnail sketch that seems to apply, and change at the top appeared to be the most available and logical response. Other commentators suggest that the old line connections to elite seats of power ran their course in the rejection of those affiliated with the legions of well-entrenched global bankers who are responsible for much of the financial destruction of people's lives as they continue to manipulate the strings of capital on the economic stages around the world. There are other analyses, of course, but let's take a quick look at what the common thread is between the two that I just mentioned. It is that people the world over lack the money power needed to thrive, and that the people who are holding the keys to their prospects have firmly clenched their fists of control and will not let go. Enter public banking. When citizens can protect their money and commonwealth from the private parties that have the inside connections to extract and exploit it, there's new hope for reviving the sickly patient that we call our economy. But the people will be the ones who have to make this happen. Washington and Wall Street will not make the systemic changes necessary to level the economic playing field so that all of us get to play. But public banks open a potent prospect. We can keep our money at home to invest in ourselves and our communities, our infrastructure and schools, our innovative and entrepreneurial interests, and begin to turn this situation around. Banks that belong to the people and work in the public interest, that can stop the extraction of public funds in order to build a more promising future. This is what all the voters wanted, no doubt. If we will continue to work toward democratizing our money so it can be put to work for us through new American public banks, we'll have made the best of this revolutionary election. So let's keep working on it. After all, it's our money. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with